Tjena allihopa, välkomna tillbaka till Parabolpodden. Här sitter undertecknad er kära chefredaktör Kajsa Ekis Ekman. Jag är tillbaka med en internationell gäst, ingen mindre än Chris Smalls. Welcome to Sweden.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what do you think about our country?
It's cold. And dark, but I love it here. You know, this is my second time here and I'm seeing some familiar faces and I'm definitely have a lot of support here. So it's a great country. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, you posted recently that as opposed to the US, where I think union membership is like 6% or something, here in Sweden, it's like 70 to 90%. Yeah. So that's a big difference already.
Yeah. I mean, I point that out as a way of encouragement for us to organize in the U.S. for more union density, more unions to organize and bring people into their membership, yeah.
So you did exactly that. You were working at Amazon, and you managed to organize the workers there, and, you know, you actually won.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. I mean, it seems like yesterday, but, going on 6 years, when the pandemic 2020 was in the height of the world, pretty much, as far as New York City being concerned, being the epicenter of the world, workers were definitely afraid and losing their job, and Amazon doubled down by firing me as, you know, the quote-unquote whistleblower, and, you know, I took that opportunity to, you know, continue advocating, even though I no longer worked at the company.
So, tell me from the beginning, like, you were just working there. You were a normal worker in the beginning, right? You just got a job there.
Well, I mean, I've been there for 5 years by the time they fired me. But I was an assistant manager for 4.5 years. I opened up 3 warehouses. The Staten Island warehouse was my third building, actually. So I've been around for a while there with the company. And, I was a modeled employee. I was really good at my job, really well-known, really popular, and also a great employee overall, you know, for the company and for Amazon. But when they fired me, that's when I decided to take my skills and my, the leadership skills that I developed over the years and just me being who I am, decided to take the fight to them.
So what was the protest about that you did in Amazon from the beginning? Was it you were already a union member or a union leader?
No, not at all. Amazon, in the U.S. at least, was ununionized before we started. And when I got fired, it had nothing to do with a union, actually. It was ironic that they actually gave me the idea when that leaked memo came out telling me that I should be the face of the unionizing efforts. And I'm like, that's a great idea. So prior to that, it was just, it was all about health and safety. It was all about protecting the workers from COVID-19, providing the PPE that they didn't provide.
And what is a PPE?
Personal protection equipment.
Uh-huh. Like so face masks and things
masks,
like that.
Face masks, gloves, you know, those type of things.
Because this was like during the lockdown. So everybody else, like the office workers, they're sitting at home.
Yeah.
They're not meeting anyone. Whereas you, the Amazon workers, you're working together, like in a warehouse, and no protection.
Yeah. It was nothing. They had no real plan to protect us in the warehouse. It was more, you know, it was ironic. We would go to work and literally sit in a break room with 500 people. And, you know, Amazon warehouses, for those who don't know, they have TVs all around the break room. So we're watching, you know, the news and it's telling us to be quarantined and 6 feet apart. And I'm looking like, well, we're not doing either of those things. So something's wrong here. And I tried to fight from internally, I tried to fight the proper way. And once again, they singled me out and then they doubled down by firing me. So they created the monster right there.
Right. And then you get the message like, sorry, you're fired. Like, what was their excuse? Like, what did they tell you?
Well, that's another thing unique about my firing was I never got a message. I never even got a termination letter. I'm probably the only Amazon worker in the world that's been fired over the phone by an actual human being because they actually don't do that. Mm-hmm. And the person who called me is somebody who I trained. You know, he was used to be a friend of mine, actually. And he was a former ops manager. And he called me up and he was like, you know, they're going to terminate me. And I think I cursed him out and then I hung up. But I got the last laugh because, you know, he got promoted actually to an assistant general manager in that warehouse. But when we won our union, they let him go.
Right. So you get that message. He calls you. He tells you you're fired. Like, what do you do after that? That's when you decide to
level up the conflict. I mean, it was a whirlwind of things because, first of all, like, I didn't know what I was going to do. There's nothing I could do. It's not like I could get another job anywhere else because who's going to hire the Amazon whistleblower, right? And then you got to think about the time was, you know, quarantine. There's no jobs. New York City was so backed up with unemployment. So I was really screwed. I had no real plan until, once again, I was doing these interviews because the media kept blowing up my phone.
And how did the media find out about all this?
It was just one media outlet after another. It was like 24 hours, my life changed. You know, it was the walkout, and then I got fired, and then I was on primetime MSNBC at 8 o'clock. And I think that was like the catalyst right there. That interview that I did with Chris Haynes, it probably was the one that catapulted everybody else into reaching out to me. And I didn't realize that they had broke, you know, a New York State law about protesting. Actually, firing a protester for protesting against health and safety is illegal in the state of New York. So Letitia James, the attorney general, took on my case. The mayor at the time, Bill de Blasio, this is before Eric Adams, he spoke out. All these politicians started speaking out about me. AOC was speaking out about me. So they kind of like, you know, brought that attention onto me, and I just used it to my advantage.
So the media was basically favorable, like, and at that point to your fight.
Yeah. I mean, favorable for sure. I mean, they loved the controversy of Amazon, I believe. I think that's what it was more so focused on. Like, this is a headline that everybody can read during the pandemic. And because it was a wave of different workers in different sectors that were speaking up, I got, you know, put up in the mix as like this face of that whole movement. And, you know, I just used that to my advantage, understanding that, you know, these interviews that I'm doing is not just for talking points for me. It's to spread the message, but also to organize.
So tell me about the walkout. Like, were you the one behind all that? Like, was it your idea? Like, you organized the whole thing? Was it difficult to convince the other people?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just me solely. It was me and my brother, Derek Palmer, who was, he was in my department. Me and my brother, we really didn't have no idea what we were doing. And this is, you know, once again, a testament to the fact that anybody could do this, is that we started a group chat on Instagram. We didn't use Signal. We didn't use any of these tools yet because we didn't know no better. But we started a small group chat with some workers and colleagues that we knew at the building. Me being an assistant manager, I had kind of a slight advantage because I was into like management chats and different chats that I can mobilize people and start group chats within the workforce. So I kind of like started this secret messaging ring where there was notes being passed, like handwritten notes in the bathrooms. I had contacted somebody from the cleaning crew, told them don't throw away any of these notes if you see them. And yeah, it was like more word of mouth. It was like guerrilla tactics. And the day of the walkout, we didn't know what to expect, but we were met by a row of media in a helicopter, actually, that was flying above the building. So we knew that we did our job there.
Because you had contacted the media before.
Yeah. The first article that came out was the New York Post, which is not a good outlet at all to me, but and to many others. But the New York Post was the only one that really wanted to write about the walkout, because the other outlets were like, oh, get back to us. Oh, let us know how it go. You know, oh, we'll follow up. They didn't believe that we actually were going to do anything. So the New York Post was like, they're known for clickbait. So they were like, oh, how many workers? And I knew I had to exaggerate a little bit. So I said like 200 workers, and this 8,000 workers at my building. But I told them 200, and their eyes lit up. You know, they were like eager to write it. They wrote the article. It came out 2 days before the walkout. And I think other media was like, okay. So they picked up on it. And I was surprised. But yeah, they sent some, some major outlets sent some trucks out there and camera crews. And
so the day of the walkout, you just walked out of the building like everybody, like.
Well, I was already fired, so I didn't have to walk out. But the day to walk out was like the first day of spring. It was March 30th, and that year, it was a warm day. So I know from anybody that works at Amazon to tell you this: if you work there, you want to get outside on a nice sunny day, because you're in a building with no windows for 10 to 12 hours. So you want to eat lunch outside for your 30-minute lunch. So I made sure that I planned to walk out at lunchtime, understanding that the cameras were only going to be filming from a distance. They're not going to be able to go on the property. They're not going to be able to walk up to the door. And the vision, especially with the aerial vision from the helicopter, it looked like hundreds of workers walking out of the building. But it was funny because the media called me at 12:30, and they're like, there's nobody here. I said, oh, well, give them 5 minutes, because the buildings are 14 NFL football fields. And then at 12:35, the doors open and you see all these workers just pouring out into the parking lot. So it looked like a walkout. And, you know, the illusion of that gave us more attention. And yeah, you could say we pulled off a successful walkout, which really wasn't a walkout, but it worked.
Oh, you mean they just went to have lunch?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's it?
I played chess, you know, not checkers.
Okay. So wait, like, they actually, like, so the people that went out to have lunch, they didn't know that they're participating in something that looks to the outside like a huge strike or something.
Yeah, yeah. And it worked to our advantage, because when the workers came out and saw the cameras, they walked over to the cameras and started telling.
Okay. So it did became a kind of walkout. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was successful to me. I mean, couldn't have asked for anything better. Like, we had our group on the outside. We had like a small group, maybe 10 to 12 people with signs, and we were right there where the media was at. So workers came to us. A lot of people that I knew worked there, they saw me, and, you know, I was really popular in the building, so a lot of people knew that I was doing it. So they did come out, and they told the camera crews their stories, and that's all they wanted, was to come get interviews from these workers and see what's really going on. And they just validated the fact that Amazon failed to protect us, which was great.
And what is it like to work at Amazon? Like, what are the working days like?
Oh, man, they're long, you know, long 60, 70-hour weeks if you're trying to make a good amount of money there, because, you know, Amazon is a decent pay rate, but at the same time, it's not, because, you know, you're on your feet for 10 to 12 hours. I used to tell my new hires to cancel your membership, your gym membership, because you're going to be doing calisthenics. You're going to be burnt out. You're going to be exhausted at the end of the day. And as I mentioned, these buildings are 14 NFL football fields, so they could be over 1 million square feet. And for somebody to do that and, you know, do that 4 days a week and five days a week, it takes a toll on your body after a while. No matter how young or old, I saw people, you know, leave the job rapidly. And yeah, I would just tell people you gotta have a routine to survive this type of job. You know, even with me being there for 5 years, I understood I had to like edit myself, make sure that I'm like eating properly and sleeping properly, which is not really much. But most Amazon workers have a second job or a third job. You know, they'll get out of work and clock in the Uber Drive or Uber Eats or Lyft or whatever because they're not making enough money there. And that's the real alarming thing is that we're working for one of the most richest people, richest companies, and, you know, thousands of their workers are homeless, are living in shelters, are living off of government subsidiaries.
Do you think the U.S. is a civilized country?
I think the U.S. is a capitalist, you know, capitalist society, you know. Civilized, you know, we have our pros and cons like any other country, but right now, from the outside looking in, it looks terrible. And from the inside looking out, if you haven't left the country, it would look like, you know, civilized if you don't experience different countries and different cultures. But for me, I got my passport a few years ago, and it's like night and day. You know, when I left the country for the first time, I was like, wow, we've been duped, you know, for decades, you know, prior to me even being born and alive, you know, we've been duped for a very long time in our country. And that's the most alarming thing about leaving the country is like, wow, the U.S. is not as powerful and almighty as they claim it to be.
How did you notice that? Like, what did you think about the world before you traveled? Like, as opposed to what did you see?
Well, that's the thing, you know, I think the U.S. is probably one of the most propagandized countries in the world. So for us, from just looking around the world, well, actually, not even looking around the world, but learning from just the curricula in school or, you know, maybe the internet. That's as far as it would get, you know, maybe some movies or docs that I'll watch here and there. But I didn't have a real perspective on a worldly view because that type of curriculum is not taught to us unless you actually study it. But for me, I've always been like a out-of-the-box type thinker, just being a musician, being an artist, being a rapper. I always aspired, even as a kid, that it was a dream of mine to travel the world, you know, in some capacity. I always wanted to have that desire to travel the world. And when I actually got my passport and left the country, I'm like, this was everything that I expected, you know. Different countries have different values, different policies, different culture, and different people. So, you know, it's been quite a journey for me, actually. You know, every day I try to learn something new, and every country I try to, like, learn their history as well.
What do you think about Donald Trump?
What I think about him? Can I curse?
Yeah, I think we still have freedom of speech here.
All right, cool.
They're trying to diminish it, you know, by the second, but
what's that song YG made? Yeah, fuck Donald Trump, you know, like, I don't have nothing positive to say about him. He's a fascist. He's a pedophile. He's not a politician. He's not a president. He's not a leader. And he's a pawn in the system that's already created, you know. You know, a lot of people focus on Donald Trump, but this is bipartisan. You know, that a lot of the issues that we experience in the U.S. Didn't start with Donald Trump. You know, he's just carrying the torch right now because he's the president. And of course he's doing, you know, extraordinary things, but this is the system that allowed him to do it. You know, it was already there. And that's what people need to understand, that whether it's ICE, whether it's Palestine, whether it's, you know, the financial economy that's rigged for billionaires, this is all bipartisan.
So did you vote for Harris?
Hell no. I didn't vote for neither. I voted independent, you know. And, I didn't vote at all, you know, last year. I didn't even bother. And, you know, I don't think I voted since Obama's first term, to be honest. For the presidential election, I haven't voted since Obama's first
term. Why is that?
Well, number one, I don't really believe in electoral politics, personally. You know, I've seen over the years how politicians, once again, they use our talking points. They get in office and they don't do anything. They don't do much. And, you know, even when I started my activism with the union, a lot of politicians jumped on our coattail. Bernie, AOC, you know, all of these progressives were, you know, calling me up and emailing me and stopping by my office, visiting me. But it was all for their own personal agenda or for political gains. And once I saw that firsthand, it still continued to irk me this day. It's that, you know, politicians will come take these photo ops, they'll show up to your rally, they'll shake your hand, smile, and then they go right back to, you know, their own personal agenda to me.
So what do you think they should do? Like, you know, these people still didn't get elected, so there's really nothing they could have done as, like, talking about Bernie and these people.
Well, I mean, I don't think politicians, I mean, it's not even think. I know that, you know, politicians are not our savior. And I don't expect anything from them. And that's what I think, you know, as an activist, as an organizer, I think we all should think that way. We shouldn't expect politicians to do the right thing or give us anything, because historically they just don't. And the breadcrumbs that we get are just breadcrumbs. And I think a lot of people take these breadcrumbs and like, oh my God, they've done so well. They look what they did. And it's like, on a broader scale, on a larger scale, it's very micro, it's very small. And understanding that I was able to organize a union on the only red borough out of the five in New York City, it didn't come down to politics. It came down to the shop floor. And I think that's how I organize within my community. And even what you're seeing now with ICE in Minneapolis, you know, that's not because politicians, it's because the community is uprising. And that's what we need. We need more community uprising.
So, like, how many people in the U.S. are organized, like, in a union?
like you said, single digits. Single digits, 6% in the private sector, 9% in the public sector. So maybe less than 15 million people total, something around there. You know, it's not much. It's a very small, the labor movement in America is a very small bubble. And it seems like we're huge, but, you know, because it's this historical unions that's been around for some of them over 100 years now. So you would think that, oh, wow, they've been around for over 100 years, that they have, you know, millions upon millions of workers. And, you know, they don't. Some of them do, but majority of them don't. A lot of them are a dying breed, or, you know, they lost a lot of members over the years. And
why is that? Do the companies not allow their workers to organize?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we got right to work laws in certain states, especially in the South. You got at-will laws where companies can fire you at will with no excuse. You got, you know, ever since the Taft-Hartley, since, you know, pretty much the 1930s, then you had the Reagan era where those laws where, you know, regulations and penalties on unions are still in place till this day. And then you have a National Labor Relations Board that is $20, $30 million in debt and understaffed. And right now, they're not even operating. And Donald Trump dismantled the board within the first 2 weeks of office. So we have no government federal entity to even protect workers right now in our country that's actually working. Then you have no laws that have been touched since the 1960s. And then you have corporations and billionaires that are spending millions of dollars on union busting. So you're not just battling the employee. You're battling several powerful entities along the way.
And still, like, I can imagine, like, Reagan and those people did that partly to bring jobs back, right? Because they've been talking about that for a long time. Like, jobs are going to Mexico or to China, wherever, but it's not helping as far as I can see. Like, they're still, like, mainly producing your goods in other countries, right? Like, the stuff that you're wearing, the stuff that you're using, like, your cars, your clothes, like, whatever, it's not being produced there, I think, right?
Right, of course not. Of course not. I mean, besides, like, you know, American-made cars, and which is Ford, or, you know, there's some other, you know, businesses and things like that that are American-made. But most people don't really shop. I mean, at least for me, I don't shop for American-made products. You know, I really don't look at that as a way for me to go consume. As far as me, you know, I like the free 99. So if people send me clothes, or if I'm able to thrift, I'm a thrifter. Or, you know, a lot of stuff is custom made because I like to be different and stand out a little bit. So that's how I look at my, you know, for me consuming in that capacity. But, you know, America is, it's funny to me when people say, like, you know, we gotta, you know, China's our enemy, or, you know, Mexico, or our neighbors, or whatever, our enemies. When I'm like, well, what natural resources do America really have? Like, you know, we want to get oil from all these other countries, and, you know, other resources, minerals and things like that from all these other countries. Do you really believe that, you know, it's on Russia or China's agenda to try to take over the U.S.? Like, what is here? You know, it's not really much. And that's what I always think about. It's funny to me when I think it, put it like that. There's nothing really here. You know, we have some land. We have some farmland. We have things like that, you know. But other than that, we don't have many natural resources in the U.S. and that you can't find elsewhere. And, you know, a lot of, you know, once again, we are the belly of the beast when it comes to capitalism. So I think people look at us as a gold pot, which that is also up for debate as well.
Do you think the American empire is in decline?
Oh, I think so. I think it's what they say, every 250 years, an empire fails. So we're at our 250th birthday this year. So there you go.
Are you hoping for this?
Am I hoping for it? No, I don't. I'm not hoping for it because it's probably going to get bloody, you know, very bloody. You know, we're talking about a country with the most guns on phase one of a civil war. And yeah, you know, it's going to get violent if it does happen. And you know, unfortunately, I want a revolution, but I want my children to be alive. And that's something that I have to think about all the time as a parent is, you know, me, I can protect myself. Kids can't, you know, and I don't think people are thinking about when it comes to all of the things we're dealing with. I don't think it's sad to say that a lot of people in leadership are not even worried about what their children's future, what their children are going to witness when they grow up.
So, what do you think about, like, the current political situation in the U.S.? Like, who is the vanguard? Would you say it's the students, it's the workers, it's some political party, some organization?
It's the people, yeah. I mean, I can't put my finger on one entity or one person or anything like, you know, anybody that at the top of the, you know, top of my head right now, but I could say there is a temperature that is being set right now, and that is coming from the youth for sure. And we saw that with the encampments, the universities, even with the younger generation speaking out. I know from my personal experience, I've been to a number of different elementary schools and middle schools, and they're telling me that Jeff Bezos is a bad person. So just understanding that the kids are paying attention, younger adults are paying attention at a younger age. You know, hope is still alive, of course. And it's not going to be one entity, because I have this saying that you know, the movement doesn't belong to one person, right? It belongs to the people. And I think there is still great organizing going on in the U.S. Unfortunately, it gets drowned out because we're distracted every week. There's something new. And that's another problem about the U.S. is like we have amnesia. Like, think about what happened with even with my union and my historical victory that happened, what, 3 years ago now? A lot of people probably don't even remember it, or most people don't even reflect on it. It's like, oh yeah, that happened.
What was the historical victory? Tell me about it.
Becoming the first union in American history for Amazon workers was one of the biggest labor history victories in over 100 years in the country, I say of all time. And to take on Amazon, which is the number two employer in the world, you know, to take on one of the most richest and most powerful companies in modern times and win, that wasn't no easy fight. And even though we got a lot of attention, people still don't understand the magnitude of it, because there's so many different distractions going on. And that's something that I've noticed, is that you know, you can make American history and people still walk right past you. And that's something that it's it's mind blowing to me, you know, even till this day. You know, when I go back to the U.S., a lot of people are like, well, you know, you probably need security to walk around. I'm like, no, I don't actually. I fit right in the crowd, you know, because a lot of people, if I don't tell them, or if I don't point them or spoon feed them the information, they don't really go seek to understand, you know. And that's a really big issue with a lot of Americans, is that they don't get involved with things until it directly impacts them.
But you did win in the end. So how did that happen?
And once again, it was nothing, no secret formula. It's just people power. You know, we were able to bring people together from all different backgrounds, all different creeds, intergenerational, intersectional, in a creative way, to create a culture and at a building where I was fired. And the consistency and the leadership of me getting up, you know, day in and day out to talk to workers, that's all it took, was that I led by example by being out there with my team, being out there with my union, fighting in the trenches. And that formula has yet to be repeat. That's why till this day we're the only union still in the U.S., because other unions are not taking that same route. Instead, they want to take shortcuts, or they don't want to put in the work, you know, and that's
so important. Despite being fired, you went back every single day to the same plant or and talk to the people, like your former colleagues and everything.
Yeah, I set up an encampment right outside of the warehouse at a bus stop, which is, you know, even before the encampments at Columbia. So, you know, it was a proud moment when the students started it, because I was actually with them when they did at Columbia University. And it reminded me of what we did at Amazon 2 years prior. So, yeah, it was an encampment set up at the bus stop, a public bus stop. And Amazon didn't know how to handle that. You know, they doubled down by union busting, spending millions of dollars, using the NYPD to, you know, arrest us and accost us and try to intimidate workers. But at the end, ultimately, we won because we were consistent. And I refer this to, you know, one of my favorite childhood books is like The Tortoise and the Hare. You know, like Amazon's the rabbit that was just drilling, union busting. And we was that turtle that just slow pacing, steady, just consistently talking and educating our members and building, and we won.
Would you say that patience is very important? Is that key for somebody who wants to follow your example?
Absolutely. I mean, look at me. I mean, I'm always chill. Nah, you know, it's true. Yeah, it's like, you know, when you're under pressure, you can easily make a wrong decision when you're like flustered. So you got to realize the type of fight that we signed up for is a lifetime fight. So it's a marathon. It's not a sprint, but people want results like right away. So they're like, oh, whoa, you guys didn't do much because we didn't win like tomorrow. And it's like, you know, you gotta, sometimes these fights can take years. They could take months. They could take weeks. So you gotta understand that this is a lifetime struggle. Like there's going to be setbacks. So I don't count wins and losses. I say that it's only a loss if you give up.
So now there is a union at that specific Amazon plant, which doesn't exist anywhere else. Have they already gotten like some benefits because of the union?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we haven't gotten a contract, which is another, you know, debacle in our U.S. system is that we won historically. History and all of these things are being praised and being invited to the White House and once again meeting with all these politicians in the last administration. And the last administration had an opportunity to give my union a bargaining order and they didn't.
What does that mean?
Give us an order to negotiate a contract with Amazon, meaning that force Amazon to the table. And the Biden administration didn't do it. So we're not going to get that from the Trump administration, which means that the only option for my union to get a contract now is to go on strike. And it's not just my union, but with many other unions that are fighting for contracts right now, they have to strike because there's no other option. And yeah, you know, unfortunately, we're still the only building in the U.S. that's unionized, even though we're affiliated with the International Brotherhoods of Teamsters. They're fighting a different type of fight when it comes to Amazon. A lot of, you know, of course, similarities to our fights because we're affiliated and, you know, the Amazon drivers deserve a union too. But we're talking about, you know, full-time fulfillment center warehouse workers where, you know, they don't have much options without a union. Amazon controls their destiny, so... for me, in my union, we have to go back to the basics, which is get back to the ground, continue educating people on going on a strike, and also connecting the strikes with international solidarity. Amazon has been unionized in other countries, Italy and France, for over a decade. I went there personally to visit those unions while I was the Amazon union president. And I even got a contract from those unions to bring back to the U.S. to show workers, like, hey, this is possible. And that's what we need to do. We need to educate and also agitate and then, you know, organize.
And you've also been active when it comes to Palestine. Tell me about that. Like, how did you start... How did you decide that this was going to be your fight?
I think it was just natural. You know, I do a lot of events, a lot of speaking engagements, a lot of panel discussions, and this random prior to October 7, I was invited to do a panel discussion. I ended up on a panel discussion with a prominent figure in Palestine, from Palestine, Dr. Mustafa Borguti. And he gave this 75-minute talk on Palestine, going back to the first Nakba. Me and him had a great conversation afterwards, and he invited me to go to Palestine. And it never happened because of October 7th. But I happened to be in Berlin, Germany, which is one of the largest Palestinian diasporas outside of Palestine. And I saw for my own self, like, what, you know, how could I turn away from this community being under attack, really, being kettled, being arrested, being dragged away, being suppressed. And I shared that moment. And when I shared it on my Instagram and saw the attacks and the amount of people, the thousands, 5,000, 10,000 people that unfollowed me, I knew right then and there that this was something that was important to speak up on. And that's exactly what I did.
So the number of people who unfollowed you didn't make you think, oh my God, I made a mistake. They don't like this.
No, because it didn't make any sense of why they did it. Because they said, I supported you with Amazon, but this is where I draw the line. And you know, I'm like, well, first of all, you didn't support me with Amazon. You know, that's another thing that really ticked me off. It's like, these people were like, oh, we supported you. And it's like, actually, none of y'all supported me. None of y'all. The people who supported me are the ones who organized with me. We didn't have any major unions backing us. We didn't have no politicians backing us. We had a GoFundMe. We had $2.50 in our bank account the day we beat Amazon. We had no support. So, like, it's just not true. Like,
people, so when they say they supported you, that means they followed you on Instagram, right, or something
like
that.
Right. You watched from the sideline. Like, you wasn't, I know exactly who I was in the trenches with, and it wasn't you guys. Yeah, so, yeah. Unfollowing me was a loss for them, an L for them. And also just trying to say, you know, this is where we draw the line. It's like, well, as a trade unionist who was supposed to represent the entire working class, tell me a reason why we exclude Palestinians. And it's like, there is none.
So demographically speaking, who were the people who unfollowed you?
Oh, it was everybody. Uh-huh. Oh, it was, you know, you're talking thousands of people. I didn't even care, you know, to even, like, you know, try to decipher who it was. Most of them were probably shit libs or libs or Democrats, mostly Democrats, supporters, those who support the Democratic Party.
And you also lost a movie contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lost a $2 million Hollywood film, I guess, a feature film that was supposed to be about, you know, my, you know, Amazon victory. You know, I mean, technically, it's like, you know, they tried to wait it out to see, and then they tried to say, oh, it was because of the strikes, because there was a lot of SAG after strikes. But I just think that I had a Jewish entertainment lawyer at the time. I felt that he felt some type of way. He had mentioned it to my book agent. So I knew it was going to come a point in time where I was going to lose it. And when they finally, it was like, oh, we're not going to renew, you know, your rights. I said, oh, well, that was expected. So.
That's a shame. You don't think they're going to come back?
It's a possibility. I mean, you know, my book is coming out this year. It'll be out June 2nd. And depending on how well the book does, maybe some, you know, film companies come back to the table. But if they don't, it doesn't really matter to me, you know. We have a documentary that's out called Union. You can watch it now. Ironically, it's on Amazon Prime, and they even want to make money off of it. But we don't get paid from this, you know. The documentary, it was actually one of the best documentaries that came out last year and made it to the short list of the Oscars. And yeah, it's a really good film, a really good tool for organizers to watch and use.
So you're traveling a lot. You're going to Greece, Italy. You've also been to Cuba, I think. Tell me about it.
Yeah. I've been to Cuba 3 years ago. I had the opportunity to go and participate in like the Fidel Castro University boot camp, you know, and it's not really a boot camp, but it felt like that because of the blockade and the type of trainings that we had to go through. It felt really militant, and that's what I loved about it. They're very disciplined people, very resilient, very loving and caring. Like, it's unmatched, the type of hospitality that these people have. And you know, it was a very eye-opening experience. I was a part of a U.S. delegation for labor. I brought, like 10 to 15 people from my union came. And it was a beautiful experience for us. We got to meet people from all over the island. We got to meet the president. We got to go to the museums. We got to go to Fidel Castro's house. And we also donated about 60 pounds of medical supplies to the hospital. So I really, really enjoyed the experience. And I'm looking forward to going back, which hopefully will be this year.
What do you think about Trump's new plan to, you know, impose like a total blockade on oil? Now he kidnapped the leader of Venezuela, so they're no more sending oil. We don't know what's happening in Mexico. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, once again, this is something that, you know, that is expected with Trump and his rhetoric and, you know, the type of abuse that he's going to use as the president, we had to resist it. And, you know, I know there's some comrades of mine that are in Cuba right now. I know there's some comrades of mine that I'm probably going to join in Venezuela in a few weeks. So that's my stance on it, is that as a labor leader, we have to sometimes take on the brunt of some of these difficult, uncomfortable conversations, but I'm willing to do it. And that's, you know, that's something that I also signed up for as a trade unionist, is that international solidarity is hand in hand, and we have to fight back in every way possible. So hands off of Cuba. Viva Cuba. Cuba sí, blockade no.
How about Black Lives Matter movement? Is it still alive in the U.S.?
Yeah, there's still some chapters that are still thriving. The biggest one that I can that I represent is the Black Lives Matter chapter in L.A. BLM Grassroots. I'm actually wearing one of the comrades, you know, gave me this in L.A. You know, shout out to them. And they actually have a chapter here in Sweden that they work with, you know. So the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. Still alive. It's not, you know, it's not as big as it once was because, of course, the distractions and, you know, the propaganda, the fight against it. But there's definitely a strong chapter in L.A. that I always praise because they do amazing work every single day, every single week, they're out there.
So, where are you going next after this?
Ooh, great question. I'm going to Italy. Shout out to Italy that's going to be calling their third general strike on February 6th. We're going to be in Geneva with the USB, the largest trade union federation. Going to be on the front lines. You're going to see me out there on the front lines as they shut down their entire country, bringing their country to an economic halt. For those who don't know, they occupied every high school, every university. And the trade unions are very, very much at the forefront of this fight. So I'm proud to be joining them in a few days right after this.
So you're a full-time lecturer now and speaker. You didn't go back to working at, you know, Amazon or another company, like, after all this?
No, absolutely not. I mean, no way Amazon's going to have me back. And I wouldn't go back even if I, you know, I put enough time at Amazon. But
do you think we should boycott them?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the boycott is it's a way of fighting back and resisting, you know. But at the same time, a lot of their revenue comes from, unfortunately, the military-industrial complex. You know, like the AWS, the Amazon Web Services, the Pentagon contracts that they have. Even if we did boycott them on the retail side, it wouldn't really do much.
I thought it was all the books that I bought that made them rich.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I buy a lot of books from there.
Yeah, everybody think they still a bookstore. It's like, no. You know, Amazon is called the everything store. And that's because they control all the markets and they put, you know, small businesses out of business.
We're going to buy your book anyway. If we're going to buy it on Amazon or not, we don't know, but we're looking forward to it. And thank you so much for coming to Sweden. It's been an honor having you. And yeah, if you like this podcast, you can also see the recording that we did of the meeting that Chris had with lots of trade union leaders and activists the other day. That's also going to be out. Hej då allihopa.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.